Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Miles Beale, the Chief Executive of the Wine and Spirit Trade Association. How are you, Miles?
I'm well, thanks, Chris. And you?
I'm very good indeed. I've never had a illustrious person of the Wine Spirit Trade Association such as yourself. I've had your press guy, I think, about 8 years ago.
Sure.
And
he
was telling us all about Wine and Spirit Trade Association. But
it's lovely to be described as illustrious. I'll take that.
Do take it. Take it well. We're at the London Wine Fair at the moment, and yesterday I sat in a presentation that you were part of about Brexit. And I think I'd really like to get my teeth into Brexit in a big way.
Sure.
But for the people who missed the podcast about 8 years ago, do you want to just give us a quick overview of the Wine and Spirit Trade Association?
Yeah, sure, no problem. So the Wine and Spirit Trade Association is exactly what it says on the tin, a trade association for wines and spirits and anyone selling them or buying them here in the UK. We basically do four things. The first is to be a voice for the industry. A second is really to look after corporate social responsibility for the industry, making sure we're doing the right things. And the third and fourth things are two ends of a spectrum. At any given point in time, our members can ring us and ask us what they legally need to do to carry on their business. And lastly, lobbying. So we're lobbying upstream, as we describe it, which typically I'd have described as being in Brussels 10 years in advance of European legislation landing in the UK. We're going to have to think of another example in 2 years' time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right. Okay, so lobbying's quite a big one, and I presume as part of Brexit, you're lining yourselves up for quite a lobbying.
You know, yes.
And normally just before the budget, you hear all the press releases from Wine Spirit Trade Association about why we shouldn't put the taxes up and all this sort of stuff. But this is quite a different kettle of fish, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's bigger for the industry overall because, you know, it affects every single part of the industry. The thing that's difficult about it is an excise duty rise affects the whole industry, but you know exactly what it is and you know what the impact will be and you can more or less plan for it. With Brexit, we know lots of questions. We know almost none of the answers.
Yeah. All right. Just before we get into Brexit in a big way, I think from your point of view, I've got a document that you guys have put called Brexit, the Road Ahead for the Wine and Spirits Industry. And the thing that really stuck out to me, and it probably drives your positioning a wee bit, is when you look at the volume of wine spirits, we import a lot of wine and we export a lot of spirits.
Yes.
We don't importing spirits, I'm sure we do, but it's the importing of wine and the exporting of spirits seem to be the two big high-value activities.
Yeah. Yep, quite right. So one of the things we're very proud of, actually, is that document was produced in November, and it's still useful. Quite some months further on, it's still relevant. The other thing that we're very proud of is the fact that we and our European Trade Association, so the one that represents all 28 wine associations and spirits associations, are using the same slide, which effectively says the UK imports from the EU something like €3 billion worth of wine every year. And going in the other direction is well over €2 billion euros worth of spirits. So if you're just looking at trade across wines and spirits, there is a very sensible negotiation to be had where all parties benefit from keeping trade flows going. I'm fond of saying, you heard me say it yesterday, we're going to work very, very, very hard to achieve nothing. By which I mean we want no change in the pattern of trade. We want no barriers to anything coming in or out of the UK for our industry.
The trade barriers or whatever, you know, any issues or changes are going to be broken down into two areas. It's going to be tariffs,
yep,
and non-trade barriers.
Yes.
And do you want to just tell us a wee bit about how Europe has tariffs at the moment and whether you think we would be likely to employ our own tariffs, etc.?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, a little bit on that. Just first of all, to put it in perspective, the way things currently work, you know, it's broadly speaking half of wine that's imported into the UK that comes from the EU. And the UK remains the world's second largest importer of wine by volume and by value.
Yep.
So per capita, by far the biggest.
I notice that Germans have more volume and the Americans have more value.
That's exactly it. Yeah,
quite. So the Germans drink more cheap stuff and the Americans drink less expensive stuff, but we've got that sweet spot in the middle.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I have to say it's historic. One of the things that is making us fearful about Brexit is, you know, we are and always have been a trading nation. And you know, hundreds of years ago, you know, but you know, the preeminent trading nation in the world, and we were sat, you know, living cheek by jowl with the greatest wine producing nation in the world until a few hundred years ago, and actually that was hugely advantageous to both mainland Europe and the UK. Well, we've been ebbing away from that ever since, and I think Brexit is now going to accelerate that, even if it ends up, you know, in a reasonably smooth Brexit as they describe it. So. My feeling is that the UK market, which has been gently tipping away from old world towards new world, will accelerate that trend. I think that's pretty inevitable. Just getting back to tariffs, I mean, look, the way tariffs work at the moment is that, you know, the UK effectively has its tariffs shared with any deals the EU has. So the way it works at the moment is all wine coming from the EU is tariff free. In addition to that, the EU has deals, free trade deals with Chile, and although it's slightly different, it's a quota system with South Africa. Those are both developing nations, and so the free trade agreements have bound in tariff-free access for wine producers from those nations. So there's no tariffs on any of the wines from Europe or those two nations. If we leave Brexit, it's possible that we'd have to apply the World Trade Organization standard tariffs to all of those nations. And just to give you an idea of the impact, we calculate, you know, more or less, this is all quite rough, but tariffs cost about 4p per bottle for every bottle on the UK market. If tariffs
for every bottle in the UK market.
If you averaged it out across every bottle, so it's not on wines coming in from those nations I've mentioned.
So a New Zealand bottle of wine will probably have 8p of tariff on it or something like that.
Well, something like that, yeah. It's probably harder to judge because it's all really done via volume. But the average, if you netted it out at the moment, tariffs cost about 4p per bottle. Worst outcome, and tariffs, WTO tariffs were put on wines coming in from Chile, South Africa, and all of the EU, that would go up to about 10p per bottle. So it's quite a big difference, but it's 10p a bottle.
It's one budget, really, isn't it?
I was just about to say. Put it into perspective, the last budget was a 3.9% increase. That's 8p per bottle. So tariffs, exactly as you said at the top of the show, you know, they're important, but they are actually less important than domestic taxation policy and less important than non-tariff barriers, which we should come back to in a minute.
And that's why if we do have a Brexit at the moment, European wines have a competitive advantage against non-European and Chilean South African wines.
Yes.
So if you're an Australian importer, it might actually start to look better for you competitively compared to, say, a French wine.
There's two ways it could look better. One is that the playing field is entirely even again. So the tariffs that are paid on Australian wine are also paid by, you know, every other wine-producing nation exporting into the UK market. The other way around, which is the way I would prefer it works, is that in future, you know, we leave the EU. It's not within 2 years. It's a slower deal. And we keep the tariff-free access that we have with the EU, Chile and South Africa. But then the first thing we do when we come out of the EU is we you know, have a free trade agreement with Australia, New Zealand and other wine producing nations where we get rid of the tariffs. There's no reason we couldn't come to that sort of agreement.
Yep.
The UK would want something in return, but I think that would be in everyone's interest. It would liberalise trade.
Who would want? The EU would want something in return for
No. We, the UK would, but that's the whole point. It's a free trade deal, and I think the way the UK is likely to approach this is that we would want to see tariffs where we possibly can disappear. So it's not just, you know, that's not exclusive to the wine industry, but we do wines and spirits, and the obvious comparison is there's very few tariffs on spirits at the moment. We'd want to see the remaining ones on spirits and all of the ones on wines disappear in all new trade, bilateral trade arrangements with Australia, New Zealand, Argentina, etc.
We're a wine show, not a spirit show, so I don't want to dwell too hard on the spirits. Is there any tariffs on exporting spirits?
There's no tariffs on spirits under WTO arrangements, with the exception of rum in a couple of places. So it's basically tariff-free already, so there's nothing really to be gained or lost by leaving the EU.
All right, so it's the wine has the advantage for new world producers, perhaps, and but no problems with spirits.
Well, the advantage would come if we change the existing tariff arrangements. Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about non-trade barriers then, because I think it sounds like tariffs aren't going to be a problem. It's the non-trade barriers, and the reason I say that is because it doesn't take much to have trucks backed up at Dover, and I'm sure Calais is just exactly in the same spot. What are the risks in terms of non-trade barriers?
So, I mean, to be honest, there are quite a few, but you've put your finger on what is worrying us most of all. If we exit the European Union, so-called hard Brexit, in 2 years' time, where essentially we've rushed through a divorce, but we have not agreed a future relationship, then we are likely to end up with a capacity issue. I mean, we suddenly have a hard border with the rest of the EU. I don't know how we go about monitoring that. I mean, how do customs officials, you know, increase their numbers to monitor what's coming in? Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs have indicated to us here that it probably wouldn't be physical checks on everything coming in, but it's still going to be slower. And if it's not physical, it's got to be some sort of IT check. And if we're getting out of the EU, there's a risk we're coming out of the EMCS system, which is the electronic management system for movement of goods inside the single market. So it's not possible to see, you know, exactly what will replace existing arrangements, but it is very, very likely that things will take longer to get from A to B. There will be more checks, and we don't know how those will be operated. So there is an obvious conclusion to that, which is that you should bring in more stock, hold more stock in your warehouses, do something different with your transport arrangements. But the truth is that requires additional physical infrastructure, and 2 years or less than 2 years is not time enough to do that. So one of the things that we've argued right from the beginning with the government is that we must have transitional arrangements, otherwise businesses in our sector will literally fall over. And having said they didn't want to do that originally, what we've now seen in an exchange of letters between Prime Minister May and President Tusk of the European Council talks about transitional arrangements. So I think some progress is being made at least.
Okay, so the issue you're concerned about is people have to hold higher levels of stock in case there are problems with getting product in, which means more warehousing.
Yes, so it's free movement of goods. So the freedoms of the EU are free movements of labour, capital and goods. And we're worried that free movements of goods will be severely hampered if there aren't new arrangements put in place in time. And in time means, you know, if we don't think we can do it within 2 years, we need longer. So we'd prefer to see a sort of 5-year decoupling period where we can stay inside the customs union for longer than 2 years. And have new systems in place before we leave.
Okay, and you, what was the way of managing trade, EMC?
It's called EMCS, so it's another one of these horrible mnemonics. But basically, if and this is in very basic terms, so apologies to any of your audience who understand this better and certainly better than I do, but if you are moving wines or spirits, any alcoholic drinks around the EU, any of the 28 member states, you simply fill out one effective electronic form on a system called EMCS, and you can then move those goods from point of departure to anywhere in the 28 member states, as opposed to something coming in from outside where you have a bilateral arrangement which with whichever country it's coming from, Australia, for example, which is the equivalent to many more bits of paper. And some of them are bits of paper rather than electronic systems. So it's a lot more costly and administratively painful. What we don't want to do is end up with that system replacing what is obviously pretty easy to use at the moment.
Yeah, you don't go from a nice electronic system to a paper system.
Exactly right. Yeah, we'd be going back in time with that. I mean, just to give you an idea, one of the things that we've been saying to our government here is, look, we'd like to keep hold of the European system at the moment. If that's negotiable, you might have to put the odd bell and whistle on it. Great. If you do have to put the odd bell and whistle on it, we need time. That's an IT project. These things take time. There'll come a point at which there are so many bells and whistles to add that we're better off scrapping it and starting again, in which case we reckon we need 5 years to put together a new import-export system. And, of course, that could work not only for the EU but for the rest of the world as well.
Yeah,
so ultimately it might be better, but we can't do it in 2 years. We need, say, five.
Yeah, okay. All right. One of the opportunities that I saw, well, it depends on your point of view. In the Brexit debate we had, one of the issues was fake, or not so much fake, bringing wine in that hasn't paid the tax at the destination.
Yeah.
And that came up as a risk, because obviously people from the wine trade see that as a risk, particularly if you're selling wines in a shop.
Yep.
People might consider that an opportunity. It just depends. Do you want to just tease out what that was all about?
Yeah. Well, of course, look, we've got to be pretty careful with this. The law is not going to change. So you will legally be required to pay excise duty, according to the country of destination's rules. What's always so
just,
been
and just
part
be careful,
of,
the difference here is if I pick up a case of wine in Calais and bring it home myself, I don't have to worry about tax or anything because I pay my tax in the country I purchased it and we're all good as gold. We're talking about untaxed in France coming into the UK.
Yeah, essentially, you're right. There are two facets to it, if you like. Right now, that's what you can do. You can drive it to France. You pay excise duty in that country, in this case France, where there basically is no duty. There are some taxes, but it's very, very small. So it's about 20% per average price bottle, as opposed to the UK where it's 57%. So unless petrol prices are very much higher in the UK, and that's the thing that affects it, that's what people do. Of course they do, because it's all within the single market. Once we've left the single market, if you want to do that and drive over to France, actually you'd only be allowed to bring back the duty-free element. At the moment, that's as much as you can drink for personal consumption. And that's
and there's no time frame on what
quite. So you fill up a van, and generally speaking, if you can convince anyone who asks from any official that it's for personal consumption, no problem. In future, it should go back to kind of existing rules, which are, I think it's 4 liters. So that's a very big difference. The second thing that happens is if you are dealing with a customer who is in the UK, then the UK customer pays a price. And they pay that price, and whoever is selling it to them has to have paid excise duty. Now, if you're an importer and you have said to whoever's sending you the wine that it's their job to pay the excise duty and they understand how that all works, then, I mean, it never gets to the customer. It's all about a sort of a B2B arrangement, but the duty has to be paid. Now, once we've left the EU, there is a question about who is monitoring that. So I think the comment yesterday was, it was a little bit tricky. The question is, how much might you be able to get away with? Well, let's be clear. The WSTA advice is legally the excise duty still needs to be paid and it has to be UK excise duty.
Yep.
So that isn't going to change. I think what was being suggested is possibly there's an opportunity for, frankly, getting away with doing it slightly differently.
I think the example they used was member of the public or even a business, buying wines off a website in Germany and getting the wine shipped to England without the duty being paid on the way through.
Yeah. I mean, that is not different to now in that some of that happens and that gets brought to our attention and it's challenged. And actually, it is a sort of a negotiation between the two businesses. But in the UK, where there is a hard and fast rule, is you can't sell anything for below duty plus VAT. And if you do, you are likely to be caught out. So that is the floor price. After that, it's all about who's making the margin and who's paying for it. But the excise duty has to be paid at the point of destination. Who pays for it, is up to the business, and the consumer simply pays whatever they're asked to pay at the point of sale.
Obviously, all the members of the Wine and Spirit Trade Association are very upstanding people, but you do get situations where people go off to France and come back with a van load and sell it to the local dairy or whatever it is and avoid a lot of the tax. Do you think that opportunity will increase or decrease? I shouldn't call it an opportunity. That law breaking will increase or decrease here?
Yeah, so look, I think that's an important distinction, Chris. So, I think it is likely that there will be more fraud of that nature as a result of us leaving, not least because it will need to be enforced more heavily by UK authorities because we're now outside the EU. So there's not a sort of single market system. We'd have a separate one. I don't know how the authorities are intending to approach that. And of course, because our members are all, as you say, fine, upstanding corporate citizens, we would want to draw attention for the authorities to where we think that sort of behavior is happening because it penalizes businesses playing by the rules. So is there a chance that sort of activity will increase? Yes, I think there is. Yeah, it's a risk we're watching out for.
All right, then. I think we're going to wrap it up there.
Very good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much, Miles. Cheers very much.
Cheers, Chris.